Hello and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is James Abendroth. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, John. It's good to be here.
So James is a freelance author who has published several fantasy and genre fiction novels, as well as RPG supplements for Savage Worlds, Pathfinder, and Starfinder. His work has been published by Rusted Iron Games, as well as under his own company, Blackguard Press, on Drive-Thru RPG. So James, can you tell us a little bit about your path to becoming both a novelist and an RPG writer, and then how that kind of led you to becoming a third-party publisher?
Sure. Well, I've always been fascinated with writing. I can remember being a kid and typing, trying to type up a story on my mother's typewriter. So probably when I was 8 or 9. When I got to college, I actually wrote a, probably not technically a novel because it never got to be long enough. So I kind of took a break from writing other than, you know, doing some just some little fiction stuff for myself or I've been gaming since junior high too. So, you know, sometimes I would write up a character history or a country or just something that struck my fancy. And then I actually had an idea for a novel and started working on that. And then I was involved in some online role-playing forums. And one of the people I played with approached me and asked me to co-write a novel with her. And so between the two, I published mine through self-publishing through Amazon, and she published her ours. I call it hers because the two sequels were largely her with me kind of advising and editing. And then at about the same time, third edition, Dungeons & Dragons third edition had come out. And of course, I had played RPGs long enough that I had fiddled around with some of the rules and creating monsters, characters, whatever. One of my big games was the old TSR Marvel Superheroes game from the late 80s and early 90s.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So, you know, I learned modeling characters from that, but it wasn't until third edition and, you know, Wizards of the Coast kind of took the hood off the engine and said, hey, this is how you make a monster. This is the rules. These are the rules we follow. That it really occurred to me that you could do that, that you could really make your own rules. And for that matter, it's funny now, but in some ways, it didn't occur to me that somebody really sat down and did that. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to think, but somebody actually designs games and somebody actually makes up those rules and tests them out and tries them out and makes a game out of it. So I had a few ideas, and most of my ideas come from things that I want to see. So I did some writing. I have a friend who's a really good artist. I approached him and, you know, to say, hey, I'll do the writing, you do the art, but we couldn't quite agree on what things should look like and where it should go. So I kind of put that to the side. So there was probably a 4 or 5 year gap after that. And then I was attending a convention in St. Louis regularly called Fear the Con, which was inspired by the Fear the Boot podcast. And one year when I went, I wanted to run a game, but I couldn't think of anything that I wanted to run. And I went to a Death Clock concert, which that's kind of a deep cut. There was a cartoon on Cartoon Network called Metalocalypse that was about a death metal band, and they actually toured. So the players actually toured, and they had a projection screen with the videos playing in the background. So I went to that, and it has kind of a dark tone to it, and it gave me inspiration for a game where you're not the hero or even the villain. You're just one of the minions. So you're a henchman, basically, for the villain. And you're, or not even the villain, in the Death Clock universe, it's just the people who work for them. But you play a series of characters who are very likely going to die. The macabre thing about it is you're trying to make it an amusing death. And so I took it to the con. I didn't figure much was going to come from it, but the people actually liked it and showed some interest in seeing it filled out. So I came home, I filled it out, you know, I kind of fleshed it out. I made a Kickstarter video and kickstarted it, and then remembered, you know, that I had a drive-through RPG account, and, you know, I put the document together, got art, and published it, and then did a couple of expansions for it. It's called Non-Essential Personnel, by the way, if anybody's interested out there. I put out a couple of supplements for it, but then kind of petered out, and I turned my attention to the third edition, and by that time, Pathfinder field, and started working on Pathfinder compatible supplements. And then I had worked on my Savage World setting, my Heartbreaker setting, you know, the one where I'm not foolish enough to think that it's better than D&D, but it's 200 pages. So, you know, it's a lot of blood and sweat in there. I'd been working on that for my home campaign for a while, so I cleaned it up some and published that as well. And then after Starfinder came out, I had some ideas for that, so I went ahead and processed that as well. And in the meantime, because I'm terribly unfocused, I wrote two more novels and published those. And then also during that time, I helped fill out the trilogy that me and my coworker had written, my co-writer had written.
So, and with all this writing that you've been doing, and you've been self-publishing most of it, it sounds like, how successful has the self-publishing been for you?
Not very. I recently left my job of 15 years and took a long time to find a new job. And when I found my new job during the interview process, I told them, you know, I do write games and I do self-publish, and I have made literally hundreds of dollars over the last 5 years. So that's going to hit any day now and I'm going to be gone. And that's true. I haven't done the math, but even doing freelancing, I probably have made no more than $1,000 or $1,200. So, you know, you don't get into freelancing or, you know, self-publishing or game writing to make your fortune. I think even the big names in the industry, Owen Casey Stevens is probably not rolling around in a swimming pool full of money, and, you know, he's one of the big deals.
Right. Right. I was just kind of curious, you know, especially, I don't know anything about the novel self-publishing industry, and so I was kind of curious, you know, like with the trilogy and then your standalone books.
It's one of those things where there's a lot of noise out there. Every year when NaNoWriMo comes around, you know, I kind of dread it, because I'm like, well, my work's about to get buried again, because it's one of those things where there's a whole lot of free and 99 cent books out there, and you know, some of them are decent, but there are a lot of books. If you think there's a lot of stuff going on DriveThruRPG, take a look at the self-publishing stuff on Amazon. So, you know, one of the things I'm not great at is getting myself out there, and people, it's very hard for people to find you unless you can direct them to it. And it's very hard to be noticed unless something really spectacular happens. I mean, even if you get several, you know, 5-star reviews, it's still, you know, it's still buried in the noise of, you know, thousands of novels being put out there. I've shopped them around agents and, you know, no bites, but, you know, that's still the way to go when it comes to, novels is to get an agent and go through a publisher and all that.
Mm-hmm. What type of feedback did you get? I mean, do they tell you why there's no bites, or you just don't hear back?
Well, and you know, that's another thing that'll break your heart too, is they explicitly say now, and I don't remember when my first novel went out if they explicitly said, but they explicitly say we get so many submissions that we don't answer them all. We don't have time to answer them all.
So it's just a form reject letter kind of thing then?
If you even get that. I started a new round with my latest novel probably about 4 months ago. And I got one person who specifically said that they answer everything, and he answered within like 4 or 5 days. And other than that, I haven't heard back from any of the other people that I've submitted to. It's probably been about, I think it's been 15 or 20 people. They're just, you know, they're slammed. So
what keeps you writing then, if you know you're not going to get to a big audience? And that self-publishing isn't going to make you a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of work.
I like to say it's the voices in my head, and it's how I shut them up. But there is a lot of satisfaction in getting something written and getting something out there. I'm relatively sure I'm not going to make my fortune off of this, but the writing is actually what I really enjoy. You know, it's kind of like playing tennis or golf. You know, when you go out on the golf course or the tennis court, and I don't do this, by the way, I'm not a sports person, I'm a traditional nerd, but but when you go out to your local country club, only a really delusional person thinks that they're going to, you know, end up at Wimbledon or at the Masters, but they still do it because you like it, and you get a little bit better every time. And sometimes you do something that amazes yourself and you didn't realize that you could do it. You didn't know that you had that potential in there. And, you know, that's what drives you on, is that spark every now and then where you have hammered something and hammered it until it's actually really elegant, and it conveys a message that you want to convey.
So James, you've written for Savage Worlds, you know, stuff for Pathfinder, Starfinder, stuff for this Deathlock, world that you've done, in addition to a variety of genres for your novels. How does working in these different genres and systems help your writing or hinder your writing?
It helps, especially with the role-playing games, because, and this is another thing that I didn't realize before they kind of peeled back the layers back in around 2000, is a good game is designed to do what it does, right? So Pathfinder is designed to be spectacular but gritty, right? Starfinder is designed to be the same thing but in space, and to bring sci-fi into that kind of format. And gritty is not the right term. I guess granular is the right term. You will eventually be able to do really amazing things as a Pathfinder character or a Starfinder character, but there are a lot of little fiddly things to work with on the way there. Savage Worlds is a lot faster. It's a lot more rules light. And so some ideas I have are not going to work in Pathfinder because the rules don't support it. And some things that I do in Savage Worlds won't work because you just need to, you know, have that granular level of, you need to have that granular level of rules for it to work. So in the role-playing world, that's really good for me because it gives me a different outlet to do different things. I actually just submitted, the Gauntlet had a contest for their Trophy Gold system, which is a very,
I saw that.
It's a very kind of horror. It's not, Trophy Gold isn't necessarily horror. It's more survival and treasure hunting, but with a real chance that your character is not going to make it. And, you know, I have a couple of ideas for adventures that work there better than they work in Starfinder or Pathfinder or Savage Worlds, because the idea in those systems is that you're the heroes. You're probably going to come out okay. And so it's nice to be able to dip into another rule system where that's not necessarily true, or you will be okay, but you're going to come out with some scars and some long-term effects. As far as novels go, I stick mostly to fantasy, but a lot of times the fantasy that I'm writing is a reaction or is a take on a different genre. So The Lost Temple of the Soulless World, which I just like saying, I just like that title. I just is a, I wrote it when The Walking Dead was really big and when, you know, we kind of had a zombie revolution in television and movies and everything. It had had a resurgence, and you know, it occurred to me the problem with zombies is that they need humans to continue to exist and for new zombies to be made. So I took that idea and the idea that, you know, if the zombies don't win early on, they don't win, because humans can keep coming back as long as there's a minimum number of them. But if you're careful, there never has to be a new zombie. And so it's that story is about a planet where it's been a long time since the zombie apocalypse, and basically humanity starting to come back because, you know, there are zombies everywhere, but there are fewer every year. And then the princess fate, that's a male royal person and not a female royal person, kind of came out when Twilight and that kind of run of teen romances popped up. And it was, what is this story told? What is this story like when it's not the teenagers telling the story? Because as a grown person, when you watch some of those stories, you kind of roll your eyes at the all the feels, as they say. And, you know, if you're a grown person around these teenagers, what's that viewpoint? What does it feel like to be around them and trying to, you know, point out to them that, hey, what you feel right now is not what you're always going to feel. So those, that's where the inspiration from those comes from. And that's one of the things I like to do. I like to take those tropes and kind of move them to a new genre and see what they look like through a different lens.
So, you know, you've written in a lot of different genres, you know, related fantasy in different genres. Do you have one that you prefer the most?
Fantasy is definitely my preferred genre. What do you even call it? I guess literary fiction I'm going to sound lazy, but it requires too much plot and monologue and dialogue. And those aren't missing in my novels, of course, but I like to be able to, again, put a framework out there where my environment and the setting kind of tell the story as well. I remember in college, I took a fiction class, a short story writing class. I went to the first class of a fiction writing class, a short story writing class, and the teacher said, no fantasy and no sci-fi, because it's just too many capitalized words. It's too many proper nouns that don't mean anything. And I dropped the class the next day because I knew I wasn't going to be able to write in that format. So yeah, it's definitely fantasy for me. Sci-fi, I'm a real fan of the traditional old-fashioned sci-fi where really the story is projecting something to its logical conclusion, or really investigating thing. You know, really old-fashioned sci-fi, and people still do it, but really old-fashioned sci-fi is philosophy with robots and lasers. You know, iRobot is all about what is it like, what does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be sentient? What does it mean to deal with creatures or beings that are not human and are bound by very different rules than we are, but that think and feel and are alive in every aspect of the word, except for, you know, the fact that they're not made out of carbon and water. And you get into, you know, so Asimov, Heinlein, all those guys were investigating really big ideas. You know, Philip K. Dick always goes back to, what does it mean to be a person? What does your consciousness mean? You know, are you your memories? Are you your actions? It's sci-fi, but it's really philosophy with a story. And again, I'm going to sound lazy. I haven't had a big idea like that. I haven't had anything that has hit me hard enough to be able to really put in the work to investigate it with a sci-fi setting. But, you know, fantasy, you can, again, you can take other tropes and you can put them through that lens and see what it looks like through there. And then, you know, a lot of times it comes down to a scene for me. And to me, a sword fight and maybe a archer or a sorcerer on one side is a lot more entertaining than, you know, the real truth of sci-fi, which is, you know, somebody shoots you with a laser from 2 miles away and you never know they were there when it comes to the action.
Interesting. So what advice do you have for people interested in being a novelist or writing for RPGs?
Don't do it. I don't need the competition.
Oh, okay. That's an easy answer.
No. You know, I think we've touched on it before, and it sounds almost as bad to say, you know, don't get your hopes up, right? So there are J.K. Rowling's, there are Stephen King's, but and again, I'm not a sports guy, but for every, you know, J.K. Rowling and Stephen King are Michael Jordan, right? So for every one of those guys who, you know, makes their a vast fortune, there are lots of people who ride the bench, and there are a lot more people who never made it there, or who played in the minor league, or, you know, who are playing in the minor leagues or AAA baseball or whatever. So there are people who are absolutely making a living at it, and they're working very hard. I could not make a living doing this for a lot of reasons. But if you're going to do it, you got to figure out why you want to do it. And money is probably not the best answer. It's probably never the best answer when you're deciding what you're going to do. But again, if you have voices in your head that won't shut up until you get them on paper, and you're willing to put in the work to turn those voices into something other people understand, then you should. And nothing anybody says should stop you. My real advice is get out there on social media and get your presence known, because again, like I said, with the Amazon self-publishing, there's a lot of noise out there. And so you're going to have to start with a fan base that you can direct to what you're publishing. And then from there it can grow. You know, if you have 100 or 200 people who will read your book and then tweet about it, or, you know, put it out on Instagram or their Facebook, you know, maybe you'll get another 50 or 75 who will read it, and then it'll grow from there. There are always people who are looking for good writers. So you can, even if you don't want to do the self-publishing yourself, find a good freelancing group, you know, get some advice from them, and, you know, get the leads from them as well, because we're actually part of a freelancing board. And I'll tell you, the last 3 or 4 jobs I've gotten have been because I found them on Freelance Forge.
Yeah. And in fact, that's where we met, is on Freelance Forge. And that's been a really neat place for me to go. I've done a little bit of freelancing for Starfinder.
Yeah.
And it's kind of nice to see a supportive environment like that. Because like you said, that's all your competition, yet everybody's helping each other out. Absolutely. Over at Freelance Forge.
Absolutely. It's funny because, you know, you get things like, I knew Hillary Moon Murphy, I'm using air quotes with that, from the Paizo boards. So she was the venture captain for the lodge that I used to do my online play through the Paizo boards. And then Kate Baker, I knew her name from writing. And then I actually just started an adventure written by, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Taniki Boleman.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just started an adventure, and that's something cool too. So if you want to, kind of have your mind blown, go to one of these one of these freelance sites and see the number of names you recognize, and then realize, you know, they're just people. They're talented people. They're hardworking people. But, you know, Kate and Hillary and Taniki are the nicest people. And, you know, they take the time to chat with people and they do the work, but it's inspiring to see that there's nothing godlike about it, right? So they're special, but there's nothing, you know, that you can't do yourself if you're willing to put in the work and if you have some of the talent. That's,
you know, it's interesting, these three that you talk about, because I've interviewed all three of them, mm-hmm. and I've actually met Hillary and Kate at various conventions. Taniki is in Denmark. So Denmark? I don't remember if it's Denmark. I think it's Denmark.
Yeah, one of the two.
She's
Denmark
in Europe.
Finland, yes.
Yeah, so it's been really hard to see her out there. But they all came to writing from completely different areas, different
really?
Ways. Yeah, how they fell into it. So
yeah.
I'm not going to spoil the interviews because they've all been published. You can go back and check them out. Yeah. But they all have a different story, which I found really, really compelling, because I've interviewed so many people and talked to them with these questions about how do you get into writing, and everybody has a different thing in, you know, how they got into it and then their advice. But those three are three very distinctly different people in how they got into writing,
mm-hmm.
which is just mind-boggling to me.
Let me ask the interviewer a question here. How many people that you've interviewed have degrees in literature or writing?
None that I know of.
That's what I figured. You know, I almost
all over.
Yeah. Again, I dropped out of my one writing class in college, and I knew that I wanted to be a writer, but I also knew even back then that, you know, that would be a dream come true and not something to actually base your future off of. Now, I did pick psychology, which was almost as bad because I did not get my master's degree, and you can't really do much with a bachelor's in psychology, but that's neither here nor there. But I would have been surprised if there were many literature or writing degrees, just because it can teach you the form, but it doesn't. You had to have the talent, and then again, you had to do the work. And you know, you can learn the form, and the form changes, right? So from system to system, especially if you're writing RPGs, the form changes. They all have their own writing guides. They all have their own processes. So, you know, even knowing the Chicago manual style is not going to help you a lot when it clashes with the, you know, the Paizo writers.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a very well taken point there. Most people have degrees and have experiences outside of writing, and they get into writing because of something that drives them, and they want to get involved. Maybe it's playing the game. Maybe it's having an idea, whatever it is. And then it kind of grows from there, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it may have been like some of mine where it's like, you know what? I have a character that I want to be able to do this thing with, and there is not a way I can make that happen. So I'm going to make my own way to make that happen.
So what's next for James? What kind of cool stuff are you working on now?
I think I mentioned that I am way too scattered in what I do. Another piece of advice I would give to new writers is follow your muse when she shows up, and when she's not there, work without her and have a plan on how you're going to do that. So sometimes inspiration will hit, and for some reason, it's very often when you're in the shower or the bathroom and you don't have a laptop with you to write it down. And so, but when you are sitting at the computer, it's good to have a plan. So for me, that falls into the days of the week. And I work on something different each day of the week, which is probably not the best way to do it, but it gives me time to think about everything as I'm writing it. So on Mondays, I'm working on a group of short stories. I'm editing a group of short stories with the main character, about the main character from The Prince's Fate and who appeared in The Lost Temple of the Soulless World. On Tuesdays, I'm editing a novel about that character that I've finished. Well, not finished. I've written it, and I'm in the editing phase. Wednesdays, one of the things that you did not find about me is that I wrote scripts for a Texas history podcast called Come and Take It. that was created by three of my friends and created and hosted by three of my friends. And they ended that. They went for 5 years and they ended, I think, at the, I guess, earlier this year. So I'm going back and I'm editing those scripts into a format to publish as a nonfiction, my first nonfiction work. That's Wednesday. Thursday, I'm working on, I've started the next novel with the character from Lost Temple of Souls, World and the Princess Fate. He's kind of my James Bond character. So he just keeps, it's not really a series as in, you know, read, you know, this book's going to directly go into the next book. It is way more like James Bond, where you can kind of pick up any James Bond movie or book and know what's going on without knowing what came before or what's going to come after. And then Friday, I focus on my game work, and I have way too many irons in the fire on that one right now because I'm working on my next Starfinder supplement. I edited and redid a couple of pieces of my submission for the Trophy Gold contest, and I'm going to self-publish that. So I got to do a cover for that and get it formatted. And then I am taking my first edition Pathfinder monsters and converting them to third edition or to second edition Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. And some of that I do on other days. So if I have a little time, a little extra time to write, I'll go and do that conversion work. So speaking of the second edition stuff, the second edition monsters, I submitted three to the new RPG Superstar contest.
Right, excellent.
So, and I'll tell you what, it's like having your teeth pulled, waiting to see if you're going to get in or not, right? So it's, mm-hmm. you know, I submitted them early, so probably 3 months ago, I think. I think that contest started in March. And, you know, every milestone where it's like, okay, and now the submissions are closed and we're going to start the judge voting, you know, oh, great. I wish I knew what the results of that were. And then, you know, I'm waiting for the next one, which is the top 100. So I'm hoping at least one gets in there, but I suspect that they were flooded with entries. So we'll just have to see.
Yeah, I saw the number of entries somewhere, and it was less than I thought it was going to be, but I don't remember the number offhand. So our network, No Direction Network, is kind of tangentially involved with it because some of our staff members are judges.
Right.
So, you know, I know a little bit about it, and that's one reason why none of us competed in it too. So.
Right. Yeah, and I had to be careful with on the Freelance Forge because I was tempted to put a couple of monsters up and then I was like, wait, people are here. People can see it. And so I didn't. And again, you know, I was talking about people that you meet, online. And, Katrina Hennessy is
running,
she's running a game for me on the Paizo boards. So,
oh, neat.
And you know, that's a cool thing too. So you get into these freelancing forums or these freelancing communities, and then you can legitimately ask, and they usually don't mind, you can legitimately ask somebody to run the game that they've written. And so you can sit in, especially if you're doing it online, you can sit in and see what the author's actual idea for how that adventure is going to run is. And that is really cool. Again, it's, you know, it's kind of like meeting, I'm trying to think of any actors that I really like right now. It's kind of like meeting Idris Elba, right? And having him do mm-hmm. a scene with you if you were an actor. And so, you know, actually being able to see these people kind of go about their business and then, you know, interact with them gaming is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that about Katrina, because I've gamed with Katrina a whole bunch. She used to live up here in the Seattle area. And we did a whole bunch of conventions together last year. And it's like, she's just a regular person. So yeah. It's funny. You know, she's just a gamer. You know, she's a regular person. But, She's very active on the forums. She's a very supportive person, very helpful, does a lot for the community. And, you know, you forget how people tend to get viewed differently online.
Right.
You know, because you just see this, you know, you see Hillary or Kate or, you know, yourself or, you know, you see people online and you just get this idea, oh, this persona of them.
Right.
It turns out we're all just regular people.
Right. Right. You know? Well, and you start to see what a small world it is too, because, here in Dallas, you know, Reaper Miniatures is just north of us up in Denton. And so the one convention that I go to every year, which probably won't happen this year, is ReaperCon. My first one, a guy named Derek Schubert ran a game for me, and it was tremendous. And then I found out that Derek Schubert is one of their sculptors. And so, and he was there, you know, to promote his work, but also he just, you know, dropped it, you know, he signed up to run a game. So that was cool because he does some really amazing miniatures. And then I found out that he is friends with Kate, I think. And so, you know, on the Freelance Forge, I mentioned, hey, I'm going to ReaperCon. Is anybody else going? Not expecting anybody to. And of course, nobody did. But Kate said, oh, I'm not going, but say hi to Derek. And then I was like, I love Derek. And so, you know, it's kind of a small world, you know, it's a small community, still, even with how big role-playing games have gotten. But you can find real pockets of intersection, without having to look too hard.
Well, if you get the chance, I highly recommend three conventions. I'll say first one's PaizoCon, because that's a lot of folks on the Freelance Forge will end up going there. Mm-hmm. Second one is Origins, because it's not a big, massive one like Gen Con, but it still has a big convention feel, but it's still relatively intimate, you know, size-wise. And then the last one, which is a lot of fun, and it's at the end of the summer, is actually SkullCon in Minnesota, where Hillary goes all the time and a bunch of other folks. And it's just a really fun little convention. It's not a tiny convention. It's actually a pretty good size, but it's not a big full-blown convention either. And so again, you get to meet people from all over the country go to that one because it's so much fun.
Right.
And so those three are, if I were to pick three conventions to go to, those would be the three, and one's at the beginning of the summer, one's in the middle, one's at the end. So it works out really, really kind of nice.
I hadn't heard of SkullCon. That's an interesting one. Oh, but talking about this reminds me that, you know, Steve Jackson Games had their first con last year, and that's down in Austin. And so I have a friend who lives down there who invited me down. And, you know, I was standing at the registration table, and this guy came up and picked up some hand sanitizer and, you know, used it and was like, oh, I don't want to start an epidemic. And I looked over and his name tag said Steve Jackson.
Oh, that is so cool.
And so Steve Jackson is just wandering around. The first NordCon was really small. I mean, it was one big presentation room and then a couple of small rooms off of it. But it was probably maybe 300 or 400 people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Steve Jackson fans are just rabid. You know, people love Steve Jackson and Steve Jackson Games. But he was absolutely walking around, chatting with people, shaking hands. I didn't get to stay for it, but he did. Steve versus the World for Ogre. Mm-hmm. You know, I was writing for that, for the Come and Take It podcast at the time, and Steve's a Texas boy. And so I gave him a card and, you know, with my email address on it and said, hey, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you'd be interested, I actually, you know, write for a Texas history podcast, Texas History and Culture podcast, and I'm sure they'd love to have you on. And 2 days later, there was an email from him in my inbox that said, now you have my email address. And then, you know, I was able to help set that up for him. And he went on, and it was a great interview, and, you know, they had a good time. And he just absolutely just the most down to earth person, you know, just chatting and joking and not full of himself at all. So you would pass him on the street and never know that he was one of the fathers of an entire industry.
Yeah, shoot. That would be a fun interview.
Yeah.
That would be a fun interview. Well, thanks so much, James, for being on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. And I hope I get to see you sometime at a convention. I don't know if I'll go to ReaperCon, but whenever this pandemic's over and I'm able to travel, maybe we'll get down there.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, and I really need to expand out. I should probably get on a plane and actually fly to someplace where other people enjoy my hobby instead of just driving.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Sure. Thank you.